This is a Toronto Public Library broadcast.
Welcome to Live Mic, the best of TPL conversations. Today's episode features Marilyn Robinson in conversation with author and journalist Rachel Giese.
In my own childhood, nothing mattered. I mean, insofar as my childhood produced an agreeable adult life, nothing was more important than the fact that I spent a lot of time by myself with a book.
Marilyn is an American novelist and essayist who has won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, a National Humanities Medal, and a Library of Congress Prize for Fiction. In her latest collection, she explores a variety of themes. Here, she speaks about fear, in politics, and at home.
You've talked about how fear has become central to American life, that there is this fear of the other, fear of difference, fear of losing what we have. And yet the American project and the idea of America has long been one of optimism, of boldness. Can you talk about this current state that America finds itself in regards to this sense of fear and anxiety?
Well, I would say, first of all, that this is not characteristic of the country at large. It's characteristic of a loud and momentarily influential minority of people. When you look at, you know, indicators of public opinion, like how many people want to ban, you know, these terrible weapons, or how many people are offended by the laws that allow these things to happen, they're very large majorities of the American public. Something has gone very strangely wrong. It will take historians to figure it out. But the majority, even the overwhelming majority, can be basically pushed aside by certain interests that have found a way to have an extraordinary influence in the government, in the Congress, in state governments also in many cases. So, and they are people who talk all the time about fear, about threat, about dread. They seem to think that there's something admirable, you know, as if to act frightened all the time were a sign of courage. I think most people actually sort of thought this was some passing thing that was just too bizarre to last or to really penetrate the culture. And that was wrong. It has lasted and it has penetrated. And it has to be taken on as a problem of that scale. One of the things I think is that people who, for example, have an economic interest in selling weapons and so on, or people of certain kinds of extreme political views, have learned how to kind of commodify fear, make it a saleable item. They've done this through media, you know, through their own media. And that's a novel problem. It's nothing that we've ever quite looked at before. I think that, you know, the poor old human species has had to absorb the fact that the wretched old human species has indeed created weapons qualitatively different from anything that has ever been dealt with before. That is the missiles, the nuclear problem. I don't think it's surprising that people had a sense of anxiety that was, it was a new situation then. People had no idea whether anything would be found to ameliorate or modify the situation. But that was the idea, that was the sense of a foreign threat, basically. Whereas in this situation, the people that are the problem, in my opinion, well, they are the problem, they have succeeded in persuading themselves that a large part of the American population is the enemy. And that's a big change. That's a big difference. And a much more difficult one for people to deal with, I think.
Yeah. I think it was in the final essay in the book, you talk about this question of, you know, fear in a more personal way, about, finding an equilibrium in your relationship with your mother, and then she discovered Fox News, you write. And she gets very caught up in the kind of the scaremongering, the war on Christmas, the kind of us versus them. And so I just thought of it when you talked about the idea of the what's different now is the idea of this fear that's getting whipped up of Americans fearing one another. And I think when it plays out within families as well, how do we deal with this neighbor to neighbor, citizen to citizen, but then also within our own family when there are these differences in worldviews?
It's a very painful problem. I was thinking about that because really a surprising number of people have said to me, I dread Thanksgiving. You know, I haven't seen my mother in 6 months because we always have a nasty fight, that sort of thing people say to me. So I thought, well, I know what they're talking about. I wrote that essay. My mother was, God rest her, the most private person in the world, and here I've written about her. Not in the most positive terms, I admit. When I had written the essay, I sent it to my brother, and I said, should I publish this? And he said, no. But, there are some things that I feel as though I should bring to the fore. And one of them is that these lines that have been drawn in American life often run right through families and create really lamentable conflicts and antagonisms within the group of people that for most people are most important, most precious, you know? So I published the essay about my mother.
You also write in an essay about conscience. You say, I believe in the reality of conscience. Having observed it in myself and others, I'm a little surprised to find it disappearing before me as I write. When did you notice this sense of, this broader sense of the notion of one's conscience or conscientiousness disappearing? What were you picking up on? What were you seeing around you?
Well, you know, we live in a very complex environment. There's what people actually feel and act on, and then there's all this talk about how the human psyche is constructed and so on. I find that these things tend not to resemble each other very much, which never disheartens the people that are writing about the human psyche. You can read theorists who say there, in effect, is no human self. This is not not a virus that escaped the laboratory. This is something that you hear people talk about and write things on the assumption of and so on. And one of them is that the idea that people are radically self-interested, can't help, you know, genetically self-interested. The other being that they are socially constructed, that there's no self there except whatever the ambient society happens to have put together in their particular case. And so the very highly individual experience of conscience, you know, which, you know, has often singled people out heroically over against societies that are going wrong and so on. The thing that at least in major portions of religious culture in the United States has been the identification of the essential self. It has been where God meets the soul is in the conscience, you know? I was brought up actually to take my conscience very seriously, to believe that when it was telling me something, it was telling me the truth, and that there was something sacred in this that deserved to be called freedom of conscience. Freedom of conscience being precisely the capacity for loyalty to one's own highest insights despite one's own interests. I think that was a very constitutive idea in the, you know, in the enfranchisement of the citizen and so on. And I think it's a very great shame to attempt to pry people loose from the conception of conscience. Mm. Well, I think it's very ironic that at a time when the wealthy cultures are wealthier than any human societies have ever been before, that we can talk people into, again, this fearful dread of whether or not they will be able to somehow live in the world of the future, you know? The future didn't come out of thin air. It came from a population that was able to produce it, you know? I mean, we've been, if you look at American history, you know, that we always had, at least in most regions, a strong educational ethic. But after the Second World War, we had the GI Bill, which, you know, opened education to everyone who'd been in the service. They could go to college for nothing. And which led to a huge expansion of all the universities because so many of them wanted to do exactly that. And they did. And then there's this huge bulge in wealth-generating economic activity, you know. All sorts of people who are trained to think elegantly make very good engineers, you know. I mean, it's not as if these things were in opposition with each other. And when you look at the consequences of the kind of education that those men sought out, it was a huge enhancement of cultural life across the board, you know. There are so many men in America, my generation, whose fathers went to college for the first time, and then everything opened for them after that, you know. The idea that there's some opposition between letting people be educated as they choose to be educated in line with their gifts, some opposition between that and any kind of cultural prosperity, however you define it, that's a very, there's no grounds for that. There's no history to confirm that.
You, and on that point of history, this line caught my attention. You say that America is in a state of bewilderness that cries out for good history. Can you define what you mean by good history?
I mean, you know, history that, for one thing, consults primary sources. It's just amazing. If you have read some of the books that are considered the universal correct, you know, the touchstone books, you find out that people write about them, obviously, they haven't even heard good rumors about what these books can do. And, you know, I mean, we have a problem in the States now that we talk about a lot, which is, how do you know that what you hear is true? Mm. Because of the whole fake news and the fact that the head of state is a little wobbly on that point and so on. But the thing about it is that, you know, the truth sounds like truth. You know what I mean? You should find, if you're going to talk about what someone said, you should be responsible to the fact that his words are in print. You can know, you know. The farther you float away from trying to be faithful to what is discoverable and documentable, the less your language begins to sound like truth and the more it begins to sound like fabulism, you know. These great myths are generated in the academy as well as anywhere else about the past, whatever, the culture, on the basis of a book that was written on the basis of a book that was written on the basis of a book, and you don't know how far you'd have to go to find somebody actually spending a good many hours in a library. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. very disheartening.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, it's very painful. You know, here in Canada, you know, one thing last year was the 150 years of Confederation, and it became, I think, initially people that there was sort of a sense of 150 years of Canada, which of course is, you know, Canada is much older than 150 years. Right. And so the whole question of who tells Canadian history, what is Canadian history, what is the, you know, how who is absent from these stories, mm-hmm. what is the official narrative, who's been shut out of the official narrative. And I think that it becomes a very painful and hard process to have that good, real history, to acknowledge how much of our history is a degree of myth-making, how much it reflects our present desire for some, for a nostalgic past or a past that we can only feel pride in, yes. as opposed to a reckoning with a past that has many horrific things that we have to contend with and confront.
That's really true. And you know, there's a funny, I don't know what societies are, I don't know what history is, all that sort of thing. But I do know that we tend to drift toward regrettable old proclivities, you know? I think that, I mean, it's a very valuable lesson, if you want to draw a lesson from American history, that we are dealing now with ideas and attitudes and alignments and so on that we, most of us, would have taken an oath had essentially been driven out of the culture, at least embarrassed into silence, you know? And here they are again, and they are making serious moves, you know? And, you know, people don't recognize them because they have not learned their own history well enough to know that, for whatever reason, our culture has a bias in that direction, mm-hmm. and it always has to be watched. One thing that has to be said, you know, is that this present bizarre situation in our government has really, really, really aroused interest in our government, you know? there's a lot of intensification of political life at every level, you know? We have this federal system, you know, that allows big, important states like California and New York to set their own course in a very large degree, you know, or to resist mightily if anyone tries to prevent them from doing that. The whole West Coast now is operating on other principles, shall we say, or operating on principles, perhaps I should say that. So, you know, it's a lively community, the United States, you know. All kinds of things go on, all kinds of people are thinking all the time about ways around problems, ways through them. And I don't, you know, if I had to choose a community in whose hands I would feel safe, it would be the United States, you know. After all my years there, I think that almost any question arouses a serious desire to do well, and I expect that will play out in the next few years.
When you were talking earlier about the sense of conscience and how we develop our own set, our own, you know, moral compass, how we develop our own set of values. And again, we're at a moment where we are more capable of expressing ourselves, of being heard by not just our neighbors, but, you know, globally through social media platforms, I mean, all of that. And yet it seems it's harder to find that quiet stillness within ourselves. Are you someone who, are you a sort of engaged with the social media life? Do you find that it becomes a distraction for you in your writing? Do you feel a benefit to this kind of global, this ability to connect globally? Or is it not for you? Or is it something that you think we should be careful of in terms of how it changes our relationship with ourselves?
It is so not for me that I can't even give advice about it. I do think that we have to be careful of marketing always, you know. There are images of well-being, and there are always people running somewhere or using a huge machine that, you know, will make their blood pressure do something, that sort of thing, you know. There is no ideal of the self or of the good life that someone's sitting by a window with a book, you know. In my own childhood, nothing mattered. I mean, insofar as my childhood produced an agreeable adult life, nothing was more important than the fact that I spent a lot of time by myself with a book. And I think that, you know, the encounter with another mind that you make in a book is a fantastic instruction in attentiveness, you know, in the possibility of seeing things otherwise than you would see them. I think that, you know, we individually can counter mass pressures, cultural pressures, marketing pressures, by remembering things like the absolute importance of being able to enjoy being alone, being able to enjoy quiet or silence, being able to want to think a thought all the way from beginning to the beginning to the end, watching all the time to make sure it is indeed your thought.
Live Mic is produced by the Toronto Public Library. Gregory McCormick is the executive producer. This episode is produced by Natalie Curtis, with technical production by Michelle DeMarco, communication support from Sumaya Ahmed and Mabel Ho, and live AV by Jennifer Casper and Mesfin Basisu. Music is by Jairus Khan, and I'm George Panayotu. Thanks so much for listening.